Today on 5 o'clock Shadow, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee takes on the Obama administration state of surveillance. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden discusses his act of constitutional courage, and Yevgeny Morozov details how the web is now being used for behavior modification. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And over the past fortnight, there's been a deluge of revelations about massive espionage and monitoring of virtually all Americans' electronic transactions. To help put this in context, we're now joined by Shahid Buttar, the Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Welcome back to the Shadow, Shahid.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, first of all, let's just do a seriatim review of some of the recent revelations, starting with the Verizon Business turnover of documents regarding the online and telephonic data of millions of American phone calls. There are two things that worry me about this report. Number one, would it not be naive to assume that Verizon is the only company involved in such things? And number two, there is reporting of so-called metadata, but anybody who knows anything about security or marketing knows that you can take one database and match it with another. And if you know the phone number, you know what company, and then you know what subscriber, and then you know the credit cards. And even if you don't have credit cards and they pay in cash, then you do have the surveillance cameras that can be up for review. So is this thing they call metadata really anonymized?
Not anonymized at all, and nor is Verizon the only telecommunications company doing this. All of the telecommunications companies are doing this, and one reason why is because in 2008, Congress passed a law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, with then-Senator Barack Obama's support, that immunized companies for violating the constitutional rights of Americans and facilitating precisely this kind of dragnet surveillance. And a lot of us made a big deal at the time, lost that struggle, and it basically gave the companies the legal cover to do whatever they want to us. And that's sort of what they've been doing since. And again, it's not just Verizon. On the issue about anonymity, you can tell a lot from metadata. Metadata people think about is the information on the envelope, right? It's who a call was addressed to, who it was from, how long it lasted. You can tell almost, in some respects, you can tell more from metadata than you can from content. You know, from the content of communications, you learn what people say or what they articulate. But from metadata, you can map social networks. You know who talks to whom, how often, for how long. That's much more useful from an intelligence standpoint, and it's also much more useful from a suppression standpoint, because that metadata can be used to map social networks. And let's just, you know, draw out an example. You know, the next time there is a movement like Occupy, which was forcibly suppressed by the state through infiltration, surveillance, outright police violence, the next time there's a movement like that, the NSA will have the tools to basically reconstruct everyone who was involved from the beginning. And that's exactly why we have historically refused to accept powers like this, because in a free society, governments should not be spying on their people. And in fact, if a government spies on its own people without basis en masse, that is exactly one of the reasons to describe a society as not free. And unfortunately, that describes the United States today. There has never been a country in the history of humankind, including the former Soviet Union, including the former East Germany, to which its subjects were more monitored than we in the United States today. The only possible exception to that is contemporary China. And so the next time, you know, your listeners find themselves singing about the land of the free and the home of the brave, it might be useful to reflect that America is unfortunately neither of those things.
One of the issues is the degree to which private information is being turned over to state agencies, whether it be the National Security Administration, whether it be the FBI, CIA, and all of the other alphabets whose names may be unknown to us, even at this point in time. Does this not raise a question about the collusion between business and government, and are there equally significant threats from the use of privatized information in addition to state-operated information?
Great question, and it's absolutely true that more or less anything one discloses to a private sector, either corporation or company, is available to the government. That's a safe assumption to make. With the possible exception, there are some private sector actors that, like Twitter, for instance, that are very assertive about denying government access to their records. Those companies, though, are few and far between. And it's not just the telecommunications companies. Fusion centers, for instance, around the country include neighborhood grocery stores. And this will sound ridiculous, but it actually reflects an analysis by the NYPD in 2007, which recommended at the time tracking sales of falafel to identify who would be a likely terrorist. So presumably grocery stores around the country are providing the government with information about who's buying what kind of food. And it is ridiculous. It is preposterous. It can't keep us safe. It is offensive. And it's all been done in secret. And so that issue about the corporate public-private collusion is absolutely worth paying attention to. Just note, I happened to be in New York yesterday to speak at the Left Forum, and the context of my remarks was on a panel assessing to what extent the United States is in a pre-fascist state today. And the collusion of corporations and government is one of the central elements of fascism. In addition to controlled media, which you can see that demonstrated in lots of ways, whether it's the crackdown on the whistleblowers that the Obama administration is centrally responsible for, or the assault on the Associated Press that came straight from the Justice Department. You know, a lot of elements that we have seen in the world before are unfortunately recurring, and the collusion between the public and private sector is absolutely at the crux of those very disturbing trends that we see in America today.
One of the revelations that came forward recently is the announcement of the so-called PRISM, P-R-I-S-M program of the National Security Administration or the National Security Agency. And that purports that a dozen or perhaps more, some accounts say as many as 50 corporations are turning over information to the government. What is your assessment of the importance of PRISM? And is that related to other dragnets that we might have heard of, like Carnivore with the FBI or Total Information Awareness with John Poindexter?
I think the latter is where to really draw the comparison. Total Information Awareness was a Pentagon aspiration presented to Congress in 2003, I believe, and it was ultimately defunded in 2004, or it might have been presented in 2002 and then defunded in 2003. Point here was that Congress affirmatively rejected the proposal to vacuum up all known sources of information to try to compile mosaics of whatever information the intelligence apparatus might need. That was a rejection by Congress, the one time it's actually stood up to do anything useful in this arena in the last decade. Well, Total Information Awareness has been built piecemeal by a litany of individual programs. You mentioned the Carnivore database, which the FBI uses. That's one tip of an iceberg. The PRISM program that the NSA is running to basically hack the back ends of corporate websites, that's another tip of the iceberg. Each of the disclosures that we've seen, for instance, the Section 215 order by the FISA court relating to Verizon, just the tip of an iceberg. And the iceberg is essentially what Total Information Awareness aimed to establish, which was information omniscience for the state. And when you think about information omniscience for the state in the face of state secrecy impeding the transparency into the state's activities on which a democratic society is based, we see absolutely the creation of tools that could easily be bent to authoritarian uses. And even if your listeners or anyone else is inclined to think that the Obama administration is benevolent, there is no reason to presume that every future administration will be. And these kinds of tools are dangerous and un-American because they could be abused. And that is a reason why, historically, courts have been very assertive in blocking these kinds of executive aggrandizing programs. And the mere fact that the corporate Supreme Court has, like the corporate Congress, washed its hands of the need to actually defend the Constitution should not leave the rest of us in the country so disinclined to defend our rights as to not recognize the plain, egregious, and escalating scandal outrage in plain sight.
Well, much like metadata, the term benevolent is one that's open to discussion because, after all, it is the Obama administration that is blaming the beginning of some of these things on the Bush administration. And yet it is Obama who put twice as many troops in Afghanistan than George Bush, who tremendously escalated the drone murders from remote control, and who has prosecuted whistleblowers at a far greater degree than any other president.
Absolutely. And the whistleblowers piece is especially critical in the context of this week's events and the news cycles recently. The only reason we know about the PRISM program, the only reason we know about the FISA court order, authorizing blanket surveillance of Verizon customers, the only reason we know about the boundless informant program, the only reason we know about any of this stuff is that people resigned their careers to disclose to the American people government secrets that we ought to know. And those people have been prosecuted by the Obama administration at an unprecedented rate in our society. More whistleblowers in the national security arena have faced prosecution in the last 5 years than in the entire preceding 225-year history of our republic. The combined 225-year history, it's preposterous, and this by an administration, of course, that claims to be the most transparent ever and has even won awards for its transparency, ironically, in closed sessions. So, you know, all of the rhetoric about transparency is just that. It is rhetoric, and it flies in bald violation of the reality on the ground, and that is that whistleblowers are absolutely at risk. And here's the point I want to make. If we, the people, are interested in seeing what else remains of the iceberg, we keep getting these glimpses of just particular programs that peek above the surface because somebody somewhere released the documents to a reporter. If we want to know the rest, we need protections for whistleblowers. And it's ironic and particularly poignant, I think, that just last year, Congress and the president approved new whistleblower protections while including huge carve-outs for national security, so that national security whistleblowers remain at risk of vindictive, predatory, self-interested, I dare say corrupt prosecution for performing what is ultimately a public service.
In regard to corrupt prosecution or malicious prosecution or ex post facto prosecution, one of the things the Obama administration is claiming is that, quote, no one is listening to people's phone calls. But isn't that a malicious slicing of words in as much as it is possible, even plausible or probable, that if phone calls are being recorded, that they can be submitted to speech-to-text conversions and they can be, quote, read instead of, quote, listened to?
Absolutely. And I think what they're basically trying to hide behind is the idea that the government doesn't have the capacity to listen to everyone's phone calls. But here's what it has the capacity to do: record them all, archive them, store them, and then at any point in the future when they might want to zoom in on any one of us, recall them and either, you know, read them in the way that you described or listen to them outright. It is absolutely the case that people's phone calls are being listened to. They're just not being listened to in real time. And the thin thread or stellar wind programs were good examples of ways in which the NSA, the National Security Agency, has attempted to, and from what I understand from the government whistleblowers, successfully enabled the piecing together of isolated communications by a particular individual across time. So, for instance, you know, these programs have been running for a decade. The NSA can essentially reconstruct everything that you have said or have heard in the last 10 years as long as it wasn't done in person. If somebody called you, if they messaged you, if they sent you a Facebook message, whatever it is, they can figure out everything that you've heard or been told. Now, the canard about metadata refers to that particular order, the FISA court order allowing the transactional records of Verizon customers to be collected by the NSA. The NSA has other programs. That's not the only one running. And the warrantless wiretapping program authorized in the 2008 FISA Amendments Act, another piece of the iceberg related to but different from the disclosures that we've seen in the last few weeks, that absolutely captures content. There's no question that they're capturing content. We just don't have the smoking gun evidence of it because there haven't been any whistleblowers who have risk prosecution to reveal that particular part of the iceberg to the public.
One of the things that I'm sure you're familiar with, Shahid Buttar, is the term the tyranny of the majority. But I suspect there is also a tyranny of bipartisanship in America today, in which members of the intelligence committees and members of Congress are breaking each other's legs to get out front saying that this is a good program. And they're using this hypnotic word, terrorism, for what are already defined to be crimes. So how does one assess the utility of Congress in protecting the Bill of Rights and the legitimacy of the FISA courts, for that matter, which, if I understand correctly, hear only a government advocate for espionage?
Great question, and it's a deep question, inviting a lot of different angles of reflection. So I'll just isolate Congress and the secret FISA court. Congress is an utter failure. And we absolutely have witnessed the collusion across two corporate political parties to denigrate and lay waste to the constitutional rights of we the American people. And if this creates a legitimacy crisis for a political establishment across two political parties, I dare say that is the best potential outcome of this scenario, because it ranges well beyond this discrete policy area, right? I mean, corporations run our country, and it is because corporations make so much money off of the surveillance programs, and that they've been immunized from constitutional abuses, and that those abuses go on in secret, that we have been subjected to this very disturbing authoritarian set of violations over the last several years. And you can't find anyone in Congress to speak truth to that power. There are a handful, Senator Wyden from Oregon, Senator Paul from Kentucky, a handful of others, but they're few and far between. And the fact of the matter is that the leadership of both the Democratic and Republican parties are bought into these abuses. It's preposterous. I mean, they are all complicit in these issues. And I do think that the heads of the intelligence committees in particular really need to be replaced, because they have gravely failed their responsibility to the American people. With respect to the FISA court, you know, any secret court is not actually a court. The judicial function, the idea of law, is predicated on the idea that subsequent courts can evaluate prior cases and compare those cases on the facts to see whether and to what extent the facts are the same, whether or not the same rules should apply. But when the decisions are secret, that can't happen. And so the secret FISA court has basically become a rubber stamp. And as members of Congress have proposed to proliferate secret courts to govern not only warrantless wiretapping, but also the use of drones to kill Americans abroad, that should send chills down our spine, because secret courts don't check and balance executive abuses. They rubber stamp them. And we can see that very clearly in the FISA court order disclosed to The Guardian last week. You know, there's no conceivable way that a real judge would authorize the blanket dragnet surveillance of millions of people, because there's no showing of individualized suspicion. And that's exactly what the Constitution has long required for any government intrusion into information and collecting information about people. So there's no way to square the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment in particular with these abuses, and there's no way to square secrecy with courts. It's secret, it's not a court anymore.
A final question for you on behalf of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Shahid Buttar. It seems that this puts a chilling effect on at least two amendments of the Bill of Rights. The Fourth Amendment, as you mentioned, which guarantees the right of reasonable security and privacy. And the First Amendment, which also guarantees freedom of association, which could be sabotaged, misled, or even more proactively impeded. What does this mean for American freedom in regard to the Bill of Rights?
It means that we can't actually claim to be free. And I'd maybe take the point a little further. These programs frontally violate the Fourth Amendment, which is to say the Fourth Amendment is, as long as these programs persist, dead. It does not have current meaning in any meaningful way. Same with the Fifth Amendment, which is due process. Both of those have basically been written out of the Constitution. The First Amendment is where the chilling effect comes in, and it's because a lot of people will be a lot less reticent to engage the next social movement when they know that the military is tracking them. Right. And that shouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. The founders of our country knew it. That's why we have a First Amendment in the first place. But, you know, members of Congress today are either too, you know, uninformed or too co-opted to recognize that. It's astounding to me that even the courts don't recognize that. And it's even more preposterous to me that President Obama, despite being a constitutional scholar, doesn't recognize that. You know, we are toying with very fundamental elements of our society. And, you know, if we were to live in an authoritarian dictatorship, it's not like someone's going to wake up one day and vote for, okay, I'm going to check the authoritarian box. This is how democracies die, by a thousand cuts. And this is not merely a paper cut. This is like hacking off an arm. And our democracy is bleeding gravely from multiple wounds, whether it's the pervasive spying that the NSA is conducting, whether it's the FBI infiltrating mosques and activist groups, whether it's the authority to detain Americans without trial or kill them without trial based on what they say, which is by this point well established, or whether it's the authority to torture with impunity. Now, our democracy is bleeding from so many places that I do think it is past time to question whether or not we actually live in a democracy. I don't think America is even part of the free world anymore, let alone its leader. And we have allowed the transformation of our society through multiple piecemeal, discrete laws. And it is absolutely long overdue that those of us who care about freedom and liberty and living in a democracy force Congress, the courts, the White House, and the press to finally shift the discussion of these issues and restore the principles that have long made the United States a beacon of hope and freedom to people around the world.
Excellent. And perhaps next time we'll discuss Posse Comitatus as well.
Let's do it. And I would love also, next time to discuss with your listeners ways that they can get involved, because I think ultimately that's the crux.
Well, tell people what you do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and how they can be involved in preserving, protecting, and defending their constitutional rights.
Absolutely. What we do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee is work with grassroots communities to build diverse coalitions around the country to politicize these issues, not just in Washington, but in Mayberry, in Springfield, in all the small towns across America, to challenge these abuses as they relate to local police, which are absolutely engaged in many of these same efforts. In New York City, we are a supporting member of the Communities United for Police Reform Coalition. And it's worth noting that the NYPD, much like the NSA, had a secret surveillance program that it took intrepid reporters to uncover. And those were reporters at the Associated Press who won a Pulitzer for their work. The NYPD's surveillance program can be restrained not just by Congress, but by the city council. And so the work we do at BORDC is helping mount resistance at all layers of our society. And any of your listeners can get involved in that work. We're happy to connect people to Communities United for Police Reform or to work with you wherever else you might live. Please drop us a line at organizing@BORDC, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org.
Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, thank you so much for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thanks so much for having me on, Robert. Keep up the great work.
In the abstract, you can complain about Big Brother and how this is a potential, program run amok. But when you actually look at the details, then I think we've struck the right balance.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you're about to enter, so help you God.
I do.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And that was President Barack Obama defending his expansion of the surveillance state in America, followed by the oath of office given to Congress and officers of the Central Intelligence Agency, such as Edward Snowden, who revealed his identity as the NSA whistleblower overnight. We now hear, courtesy of The Guardian, Snowden, in his own words, speaking with investigative reporter Glenn Greenwald.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii.
What are some of the positions that you held previously within the intelligence community?
I've been a systems engineer, systems administrator, senior advisor for the Central Intelligence Agency, solutions consultant, and a telecommunications information systems officer.
One of the things people are going to be most interested in trying to understand who you are and what you're thinking is there came some point in time when you crossed this line of thinking about being a whistleblower to making the choice to actually become a whistleblower. Walk people through that decision-making process.
When you're in positions of privileged access, like a systems administrator for these sort of intelligence community agencies, you're exposed to a lot more information on a broader scale than the average employee. And because of that, you see things that may be disturbing, but over the course of a normal person's career, you'd only see one or two of these instances. When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis. And you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them. But over time, that awareness of wrongdoing sort of builds up and you feel compelled to talk about it. And the more you talk about it, the more you're ignored, the more you're told it's not a problem. until eventually you realize that these things need to be determined by the public, not by somebody who was simply hired by the government.
Talk a little bit about how the American surveillance state actually functions. Does it target the actions of Americans?
NSA and the intelligence community in general is focused on getting intelligence wherever it can, by any means possible, that it believes on the grounds of sort of a self-certification that they serve the national interest. Originally, we saw that focus very narrowly tailored as foreign intelligence gathered overseas. Now, increasingly, we see that it's happening domestically. And to do that, the NSA specifically targets the communications of everyone. It ingests them by default. It collects them in its system, and it filters them, and it analyzes them, and it measures them, and it stores them for periods of time, simply because that's the easiest, most efficient, and most valuable way to achieve these ends. So while they may be intending to target someone associated with a foreign government or someone that they suspect of terrorism, they're collecting your communications to do so. Any analyst at any time can target anyone, any selector anywhere. Where those communications will be picked up depends on the range of the sensor networks and the authorities that that analyst is empowered with. Not all analysts have the ability to target everything, but I, sitting my desk, certainly have the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president if I had a personal email.
One of the extraordinary parts about this episode is that usually whistleblowers do what they do anonymously and take steps to remain anonymous for as long as they can, which they hope often is forever. You, on the other hand, have decided to do the opposite, which is to declare yourself openly as the person behind these disclosures. Why did you choose to do that?
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures that are outside of the democratic model. When you are subverting the power of government, that's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy. And if you do that in secret consistently, you know, as the government does when it wants to benefit from a secret action that it took, it'll kind of give its officials a mandate to go, hey, you know, tell the press about this thing and that thing, so the public is on our side. But they rarely, if ever, do that when an abuse occurs. That falls to individual citizens, but they're typically maligned. You know, it becomes a thing of these people are against the country, they're against the government, but I'm not. I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
Have you given thought to what it is that the U.S. government's response to your conduct is in terms of what they might say about you, how they might try to depict you, what they might try to do to you?
Yeah, I could be, you know, rendered by the CIA. I could have people come after me or any of their third-party partners. You know, they work closely with a number of other nations. Or, you know, they could pay off the triads or, you know, any of their agents or assets. We've got a CIA station just up the road in the consulate here in Hong Kong, and I'm sure they're going to be very busy for the next week. And that's a fear I'll live under for the rest of my life, however long that happens to be. You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk, because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you. And if living unfreely but comfortably is something you're willing to accept, and I think many of us are, it's the human nature, you can get up every day, you can go to work, you can collect your large paycheck for relatively little work against the public interest and go to sleep at night after watching your shows. But if you realize that that's the world that you helped create And it's going to get worse with the next generation and the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression. You realize that you might be willing to accept any risk, and it doesn't matter what the outcome is, so long as the public gets to make their own decisions about how that's applied.
Why should people care about surveillance?
Because even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded, and the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude, to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call, and then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
We are currently sitting in a room in Hong Kong, which is where we are because you traveled here. Talk a little bit about why it is that you came here, and specifically there are going to be people who will speculate that what you really intend to do is to defect to the country that many see as the number one rival of the United States, which is China, and that what you're really doing is essentially seeking to aid an enemy of the United States with which you intend to seek asylum. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's a couple assertions in those arguments that are sort of embedded in the questioning of the choice of Hong Kong. The first is that China is an enemy of the United States. It's not. I mean, there are conflicts between the United States government and the Chinese PRC government, but the peoples inherently, you know, we don't care. We trade with each other freely. You know, we're not at war. We're not in armed conflict, and we're not trying to be. We're the largest trading partners out there for each other. Additionally, Hong Kong has a strong tradition of free speech. People think, oh, China, great firewall. Mainland China does have significant restrictions on free speech, but the people of Hong Kong have a long tradition of protesting in the streets, of making their views known. The internet is not filtered here, no more so than any other Western government. And I believe that the Hong Kong government is actually independent in relation to a lot of other leading Western governments.
If your motive had been to harm the United States and help its enemies, or if your motive had been personal material gain, were there things that you could have done with these documents to advance those goals that you didn't end up doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anybody in the positions of access with the technical capabilities that I had could, you know, suck out secrets, pass them on the open market to Russia. You know, they always have an open door, as we do. I had access to, you know, the full rosters of everyone working at the NSA, the entire intelligence community, and undercover assets all around the world, the locations of every station we have, what their missions are, and so forth. If I had just wanted to harm the U.S., you know, that you could shut down the surveillance system in an afternoon, but that's not my intention. And I think for anyone making that argument, they need to think, if they were in my position, and you know, you live a privileged life, you're living in Hawaii in paradise and making a ton of money, what would it take to make you leave everything behind? The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change. People will see in the media all of these disclosures. They'll know the lengths that the government is going to grant themselves powers unilaterally to create greater control over American society and global society. But they won't be willing to take the risks necessarily to stand up and fight to change things, to force their representatives to actually take a stand in their interests. And the months ahead, the years ahead, it's only going to get worse until eventually there will be a time where policies will change, because the only thing that restricts the activities of the surveillance state are policy. Even our agreements with other sovereign governments, we consider that to be a stipulation of policy rather than a stipulation of law. And because of that, a new leader will be elected. They'll flip the switch, say that because of the crisis, because of the dangers that we face in the world, you know, some new and unpredicted threat, we need more authority, we need more power, and there will be nothing the people can do at that point to oppose it, and it'll be turnkey tyranny.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden speaking with investigative reporter Glenn Greenwald. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The ubiquity and danger of internet activity was discussed recently by Yevgeny Morozov, the author of The Net Delusion. Morozov notes that in addition to surveillance, the web is now being used as a form of massive social behavior modification.
I was born in Belarus. That's where I grew up. And those of you who don't know, Belarus still has a very complicated political situation. Since mid-90s, it's been a pretty ugly authoritarian regime. And the reason why I initially got excited about the power of social media and the power of the internet was because I thought that we can actually use blogs and social networks and a lot of these digital technologies to push for democracy in the country, right? And I was a very cheerful and utopian young fellow who actually thought we can use many of these tools to build a better world. And after 3 years of working in Belarus and traveling through the former Soviet Union, working for a couple of NGOs and foundations, I quickly got disillusioned, figuring out that the dictators themselves were very active users of many of these technologies. But I also figured out that that was not something that was understood in Washington. Right, I figured out that a lot of our policymakers and a lot of our journalists and intellectuals still thought that the internet and blogs and social media were primarily responsible for liberating the world, for empowering dissidents, and they did not pay as much time to understanding how various software tools were actually used to monitor and spy on dissidents, how they were used to engage in propaganda, engage in cyber attacks, and a lot of those tools were actually built right here in Silicon Valley, and we didn't really have any restrictions placed on those companies. While at the same time, we were actually celebrating the role that the likes of Google and Facebook were playing in many of those countries, right? So we, part of my argument in my first book was that we in Washington, a lot of our policymakers are increasingly relying on Silicon Valley to actually promote democracy in the Middle East and elsewhere. And I was trying to investigate what are some of the costs of delegating something that we used to do out of the State Department to essentially Facebook, Google, and Twitter, right? And then sort of give away the ending of my first book, I wasn't particularly encouraged by the trends I saw, and I thought that there are many hidden costs and risks attached to having Facebook and Twitter and Google as the primary or even secondary promoters of democracy. So what I tried to do in my second book was to shift the attention a little bit, but still stick to the basic question. What happens once we delegate some of the responsibility for problem solving to Silicon Valley and to technology companies and the private sector in general? But the questions and the problems I focused on became very different. So instead of thinking about democratization and how we can promote freedom and democracy, I began asking questions about what happens once we delegate responsibility over fighting problems like climate change or problems like obesity, for example, to Silicon Valley. Right? What happens once we rely on technology, we rely on apps, we rely on technological fixes to address some of those problems, right? And so that was the basic research question with which I started the book. The reason why I think this question is worth asking now is because of two trends that have happened. Those trends are as follows. First of all, sensors with an S. You know, I spent my first book talking a lot about censorship, and there was a lot of sensors with a C in that book. In the second book, there is a lot of sensors with an S, and it's, you know, little tiny sensing devices which can be embedded now in virtually anything, right? You can embed sensors into cars, tables, walls, teapots, anything to generate new levels of interactivity, right? They can provide you with new information. You can make devices that were previously analog and dumb, so to say, you can make them smart. right? So you may have heard about smart devices and smart objects, right, which all incorporate sensors of some kind. So you may have heard that Apple recently patented smart shoes, right? So what do smart shoes do? They have a sensor built into them, and that sensor can figure out when the shoes are about to get worn out, and they will alert you, right, that that's happening. Has a sensor, gives you a prompt, results in a somewhat different decision. We have seen earlier this year the presentation of smart forks at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. What do? They have a sensor in them, and they can actually monitor how fast you're eating. So if they detect that you're eating too fast, they will start vibrating, telling you that you need to slow down. Again, the principle is the same. You take a previously dumb artifact, you build a sensor into it. It can detect what it is you're doing with it, and it can prompt you to behave differently. Right? The principle is the same in many of these devices. The same, you know, I can go on forever. You have smart toothbrushes, right, which again have a sensor and can monitor how fast you are brushing your teeth, and they can actually share that data with your insurance company, with your dentist. Right? You have smart umbrellas that have a sensor built into them, and they have internet connectivity built into them that can detect, check the weather, and actually have a little blue light that goes on if the weather says that it's going to rain. So the umbrella will actually warn you to take it with you when you leave the house. Right? Again, the principle in all of these examples I've specified is very similar. You take previously dumb objects, previously dumb devices, you build a sensor into them, and they allow, because they add extra information to the object, they can allow new types of behavior and solicit new types of behavior from the user, right? And that allows for new ways of problem solving. And I'll talk about that very shortly, but you know, you can basically see what the principle is. The principle is that you can give the user more information and thus get the user to behave differently, right? So that's the principle. And the first trend is the proliferation of sensors that are getting cheaper and smaller. The second trend is easier, I think, to grasp, and it's the fact that because we're all present on social networks and because we're all carrying our smartphones with us, what has happened is that you can now basically take your entire social circle with you anywhere you go, right? So in Silicon Valley, people talk about it as the social, right? Now everything can be turned social, in part because pretty much every interaction that you have with each other or with social institutions can now be mediated, so to say, by a social circle, right? So you can have apps. There is actually an app called Seesaw, which allows you to create instantaneous polls. If you are stuck with a difficult decision, you don't know what latte to buy, right? Or you don't know what dress to buy, or you don't know what politician to vote for, you can create an instantaneous poll with your smartphone, poll all of your friends immediately, solicit feedback, and make a decision, right? The principle, again, is simple. That connectivity and the fact that your social circles are portable and they are immediately accessible allow to solicit new types of information, and they allow you to make new types of behavior. But you can also think about this principle, you know, even more expansively, because since your friends more or less follow with you everywhere you go with your phone, you can create games, right, where you actually participate in competition with other people. And that's also something that Silicon Valley has stepped into in the last 2 years. Those of you who live and work here may have noticed the rise of the so-called gamification, right? And it's this principle that you can actually turn virtually anything into a game by rewarding people with points, right, for doing things that they previously did because they, you know, thought it was the right thing to do, or they did it because they, you know, wanted to save the world, or they wanted to do something good for humanity. Now, you can bypass all of this inefficient moral and ethical incentives, and instead of relying on ethics, essentially start rewarding people with virtual currencies or some other types of currencies, you know, in terms of attention, for performing all sorts of acts. So you can start compensating people for, you know, picking up litter from the street, because you all carry cell phones, and your cell phones can identify, because they also have sensors, when it is that you're reaching out to pick up some litter. You can easily automatically build a compensation system that will reward you with points that you can then, you know, compare with your friends. So this is the second trend, right? The fact that you can actually carry your friends with you, that allows for new types of peer pressure, And some of that peer pressure can be positive. It can be showing your friends how good you are and what are some of the things you do. And some of that pressure can be negative. It's kind of, you know, shaming, saying, showing your friends that you're not doing the good thing. So how do those two trends interact? For me, a very good anecdotal example of these two trends in action is a prototype design that I found built by engineers and designers in Britain and Germany. It's a product called BinCam, right? So what does BinCam do? BinCam is a smart trash can, right? So it's a trash can that stands in your kitchen. And of course, it has a sensor built into it. And in this case, the sensor is a smartphone, right? That's built into its upper lid, right? And just before I continue, it's a serious project, right? It's not an art project built by some art students. It's an actual project built by serious designers who are concerned with saving the planet and changing recycling habits, right? So it's a serious intervention. So we're talking about a smart trash bin. It has a smartphone built into its upper lid. And the purpose of this phone is to take a photo every time you open or close the lid. So the idea is that you can actually snap a picture of what it is you have just thrown away. Right? Why would anyone want to do such a thing? Well, the idea is that after you snap that photo, it's being uploaded to a website called Mechanical Turk, which is run by Amazon, where freelancers are paid to do things that computers cannot do yet. So in this case, freelancers are being paid to analyze whether you're recycling things correctly or not. And if you're recycling things correctly, you're being awarded points, which along with the photo are uploaded to your Facebook page. Where you're competing against other households, right? So the idea is that something as trivial as throwing away trash can be turned into a nice little game where new types of ethical behavior, right, or in this case, correct behavior, can be solicited from you as a citizen, right? Bypassing, essentially, the language of morality and the language of ethics, right? Because now you can actually get people to do the right thing, in this case, recycle, without having any conceptual model of understanding what is right and wrong, because essentially they will be doing it because they are competing against other households, right? And this might seem like a very compressed and trivial example, but I think it very nicely illustrates the new types of possibility of problem solving that have suddenly become possible thanks to those two trends. Thanks to the fact that sensors can now be built in almost anything, and thanks to the fact that now almost anything can be made social. So essentially, my argument is that we have ended up with a new type of privately run infrastructure for problem solving, right? And this infrastructure is run by Silicon Valley. It's run by Google. It's run by Facebook. It's run by companies who own and run the smartphones and run the gadgets. And then it's also run by companies that run the platforms where we are socializing with each other. So now that we as a society have this infrastructure, the question for us becomes, how much do we want to use it? And if we are not going to use it, what are some of the reasons for not using it? Right? What are some of the reasons for refusing to rely on the smart trash bin? Right? Do we want to do it because we are just concerned about privacy? Which I think is a valid excuse, because technically, if you think about the privacy implications here, basically, in the past, FBI could not just go to you and ask what was in your trash can 3 weeks ago. I mean, they can, but they would never find out documentally what the answer was. Now, if the smart environments take over, they would be able to go to Facebook and just ask them for a picture of what was in your trash can 3 weeks ago, and they will get it, right? So the fact that, you know, it's the same principle with the smart toothbrush, right? It has all sorts of benefits. It can monitor data that will end up with your dentist and might, you know, improve your teeth eventually or save you from some extra trouble. But it also creates an environment in which a lot of this trivial data is suddenly accessible and it's suddenly collected. I can't possibly imagine why FBI would want to know how many teeth you have or what was in your mouth 3 weeks ago, but this data, thanks to smart devices, is now recorded, analyzed, and stored somewhere, right? So it becomes accessible. So the privacy layer is important to consider, but I would argue that it's not the only reason why we should worry about the proliferation of smart objects on the one hand, and then these new types of social incentives like gamification. Another reason to to worry, and I think it's much more important, is that solving problems in this manner by essentially having citizens readjust their own behavior, whether it comes to recycling or whether it comes to climate change, is a very particular way of doing politics, and it's only one way to pursue reforms, and there are many others. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily the best way. So let me unpack what exactly I mean by this. So some of you may know Google Now, right? The app that Google has built last year. Those of you who don't know it, it seems like a very useful app. So what Google Now does is that it analyzes everything that you do across all of the Google services. So it analyzes what you do on your Gmail. It analyzes what you do on your Google Calendar. It analyzes what you do on YouTube. It analyzes what you search for. And then it tries to predict what you might be doing in the near future. Next day, next hour, next week. And then it tries to do some of those things for you. Right? So the principle is that you can actually predict what you'll be doing next and have Google do it for you as long as it's something trivial and would otherwise cause you some trouble. So to give you an example, which Google likes to give all the time, is that imagine you have a flight reservation in your inbox and Google knows that you'll be catching a flight later today. So it will automatically, thanks to Google Now, check you into your flight. It will automatically check the weather at your destination. And it will tell you that it might rain, so you might need to get an umbrella. You know, it will never get wet in this new digital future. And it will also check the traffic conditions on the way to the airport, and it will tell you that there is traffic, so you might need to leave sooner. Right? So you're trying to make your life easier by essentially analyzing what it is you'll be doing, and it's trying to preempt it and provide you with information that will simplify your life, or it will just do some of the things like checking in itself. All of that sounds very good, but now it also does an additional thing as well. It also analyzes, thinks it's a smartphone app, and your smartphone has a sensor, an accelerometer in it, which knows when it is that you're walking and when it is that you're not walking. It actually tracks how many miles you walk every month, right? And at the end of each month, without you ever asking for it, it shows you how many miles you've walked in the last month, and it shows you whether this month you've walked more or whether this month you walked less than the previous months. Right? It shows you the percentage change. And here, those of you familiar with behavioral economics or the work of Cass Sunstein will recognize that what Google is essentially doing is trying to create a nudge. Right? It's trying to do something that will hopefully result in a different behavior from you. Right? It's trying to show you information which will hopefully modify your behavior, and in this case, will make you walk more, it will make you exercise more, or you know, you can think of many other interventions which become possible, again, thanks to the fact that Google runs this new information-based infrastructure for problem solving. You know, with Google Glass, as we'll all soon be wearing, as you probably already well aware, you'll be able to monitor even more things, and you'll be able to create even more nudges, again, in part because so much of our activities will be monitored for good purposes, and it will be easy to just display reminders and tell us that we are eating too much fat, we're not eating enough vegetables. All of that feedback can be generated in real time based on our own behavior. So in this sense, Google Now is an early precursor of the kind of ubiquitous nudging that suddenly becomes available as we're all interconnected to this new problem-solving infrastructure. And you might think that what could possibly be wrong with telling you that you need to walk more, right? Or that you need to eat more vegetables. And I think that as a bonus, as an additional feature to other types of problem-solving, this is a very good intervention. However, I'm not sure that given the intellectual climate and the broader socioeconomic background to the introduction of many of these initiatives, I'm not sure that this will be a bonus. And I actually think that it will be a replacement of many of the existing efforts to reform problems, to solve problems like obesity or climate change. Essentially, what's happening is that we are replacing more ambitious ways to tackle these political issues. And what are some of those ways? It's passing new laws, regulating industries, building infrastructure. I mean, there are all sorts of things which do not require building an app, which tackle a problem at a much higher level, and actually tries not just to put some temporary patch on the problem and pretend that it doesn't exist, but getting citizens to behave differently, but actually goes and try to address the root causes of the problem.
Yevgeny Morozov, the author of The Net Delusion, speaking recently to the World Affairs Council. And that concludes today's 5 o'clock shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins, Reggie Johnson, and Sean Rhodes. We welcome your comments, questions, leaks, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.